Welcome back to In the Moment Tech Radio. I'm Jackie Hendry, filling in this week for Kent Osborne, and I'm joined in the Kirby family studio by our resident Mac guru, Joe Brovelite. Joel, welcome to Tech Radio.
Hey, thanks a lot. Nice to have you here.
Thanks. And on the phone we have from Peer, Bureau of Information and Telecommunications, Jeff Litterick. Jeff, thanks for being with us today, too.
No problem. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. And we've got plenty of things to talk about this week, but way more interesting than that, we want to hear any questions that you, our listeners, might have for us. And there's plenty of ways for you to get in contact with us. You can email us in the moment at sdpb.org. You can send us a text, 605-956-SDPB. That's 605-956-7372. Give us a call, 800-852-0214, or if you're, you know, you prefer that social media bend, you can tweet me at Jackie Hendry SD. But in the meantime, most recent news probably, the FCC yesterday votes in favor of allowing our phone companies to block those pesky robocalls by default, but plenty of questions left in regard to how that looks for us, the consumer. So, Jeff, you kind of brought this to our attention this morning. What can you kind of tell us about how this plays out?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing is up until this point, the carriers could auto-block calls without just on their own. The FCC decided to change the rules for them, and they also made some recommendations we should go over to the carriers and kind of hinted that if they don't take these, they will be mandated. So what happened is they voted to allow carriers to auto-block robocall scammers. So what this means is it doesn't require them to block, but it allows them to. So T-Mobile, for example, has a free service that you can sign up for as a customer, but you have to opt in that will block those calls now. Verizon is still looking at how they want to do stuff in their statement. Each carrier is going to probably have a little bit slightly different twist in policies, and there's nothing to prevent them from charging you a service fee for this feature to auto-block. The FCC is highly recommending trying to push the carriers to get these services rolled out, but it's going to be a carrier-by-carrier basis. Now, one of the other things they also voted on as highly recommending, and if you don't do it by the end of the year, we're going to kind of mandate the carriers to do this, is a new form of caller ID that is more secure. In that, right now, a lot of the robocalls are faking and using local numbers, for example, even though they're not calling locally through the system. This new secure caller ID between the carriers would actually stop that and reveal the real phone number of the robo-scammer and block those calls. So that's another mechanism the FCC would like the carriers to have completed their involvement with by the end of this year, and if not, they kind of hint that, well, next year we'll just mandate that you do it no matter what if you don't voluntarily set up this new secure caller ID system for everybody. So kind of exciting times. It kind of came at a weird time for me because last night I probably got the most detailed and best fake robocall scammer call I've ever received on my voicemail.
Really?
In that it was almost personally tailored very, very convincing, not the normal computer noise. It was a real voice, a real person. In fact, I think they probably hired a voice actor because of the way the grammar was and stuff. It was very convincing. But luckily, one of the things I always do when I get any phone call that asks me to call back or says something's urgent is I always hit that number into Google and search it. And, yep, they probably made 3,000 calls that scammer did in the last 2 days. It's a fairly new scam, but people report those fairly quickly anymore. So when in doubt, that callback number they give you to call back, just Google it and see what other people are saying. And it became very fast a suspicion. But people were fooled. People were actually calling back that number. It was so good. And then figuring out later that it was a scam and reporting it at that point. So
interesting.
They're getting better, and hopefully we can stop this kind of plague that's happening. So
right, and this is just a piece of some of the moves that have been made in Washington trying to counteract the nuisance of robocalls. I know Senator John Thune, part of introducing a bill to take some harsher punishments against phone scammers. That's passed the Senate recently, waiting on that in the House. Joel, what do you what are your kind of perspectives on this move from the FCC, and how useful is it going to be, really, if there's no like force of law behind these recommendations, maybe?
Right. First off, I'll say I don't think anything unites all sides of the debate more than people hating robocalls. So any movement forward on this is great.
Yeah.
One of the only major problems I see with it is Ajit Pai decided that it was okay if carriers charged extra for this service, mm-hmm. which is just totally backward. Blocking robocalls should just be built in and should not cost users anything. But in this iteration, you might get a, I'm not saying this will happen, but for instance, you could get a bill from Verizon blocking robocalls for you without you asking to do it and with an extra charge on there. So it's unclear whether that's actually going to happen, but it's legally possible for them to do that. So that's a bit disappointing. I guess we'll see how it shakes out, but mostly just very positive, I would say.
Right. And so far, the carriers that, at least as far as I've seen so far, carriers that have made any kind of statement with regard to this vote yesterday have been kind of vague in what they actually
plan to
do.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of them have said, well, yes, absolutely, we'll do this for our customers. And, you know, they can easily, you know, tuck in $3 here and say it's a, you know, convenience fee or a tax for this or whatever. And that just shouldn't be the case. I think that's ridiculous. But better this than nothing blocked at all, though. So we'll mm-hmm. see. We'll see how it shakes out. Like I said,
and another.
I will say that the carriers that offer it for free will probably be in much more demand than the ones that are going to charge through the nose for it. So
right, there's that element of competition there. There's ways that these carriers can make this work out for them, I'm sure. Another interesting concern that I've seen with this vote is with regards to liability. So if you're automatically blocking some robocalls, every now and then there's a robocall that is actually useful, maybe from your doctor's office or any other number of situations like that. But how often are we actually getting useful robocalls?
Yeah, it's a very small percentage mm-hmm. for sure. You know, that should just encourage any of those, whether, you know, good example you had from your doctor's office, if you get one there, that just encourages them to come up with a better solution anyway. I've never really thought getting a call from my doctor was so much better than getting maybe a text or an email. I think there are better ways to do that. So hopefully we'll just see a little forward movement on coming into the actual 21st century with some of that.
Mm-hmm. And Jeff, with that phone call that you got last night, was this another one of those like faking personal information, trying to get you to pay something off or something along those lines?
Yeah, I learned later because it was kind of garbled just a little bit. It was a student loan, which is a popular one right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, threatening, hey, you have it. We need to discuss repayment options and or other stuff because a lot of younger folks have student loans, and that was catching a lot of people. They were actually calling in and then finding out later it was a scam. Because the way they did it, it was very professional sounding, very nice English, reference numbers, agent IDs, all this kind of stuff. So they're becoming much more sophisticated, willing to spend a little bit more money instead of a computerized voice trying to trick you into getting that money back from scamming people. So
mm-hmm.
whenever there's investment, you know there's money to be made by somebody.
Right. And another solution that I saw, or not maybe not a solution, but an option that could be possible with something like this would be blocking any number that isn't already in your phone's contacts. But depending on your profession, if you're working out of home, I'm sure there's a lot of reasons why that on its own would not be as practical. So, Jeff, I don't know if you have any other tips for our listeners. In the meantime, until these things really roll out, if they get a call or something like that, just kind of basic phone safety.
Yeah, anytime you're suspicious. Now, like I said, there's spoofing caller ID, so the phone number on the caller ID isn't always the best to search. But many times I'll just do a quick callback, and most of the time it'll go to, well, that phone number's not in use. I immediately know it's a scam. If they leave a phone number in the message to call back. It's usually a toll or some other number. Just Google it. Because, believe me, you're not the only one they called that day. They probably called, 50 to 100,000 people. And even if only 10 or 20 report it, you're going to know pretty fast with a Google search exactly what's going on, if it's a scam or not a scam. So.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that either any of us have to say about the FCC's move yesterday, or is this kind of a wait-and-see approach as this develops and seeing how the carriers react?
Well, there's been a lot of news. The FCC's been kind of pushing for this for a while. Some of the carriers like T-Mobile have been a little bit more aggressive than other ones. We'll see how it all goes through, because I think if you don't do something for your customers and make it fairly cheap, it's going to be kind of a PR nightmare for you later on when your competitors point out that fact. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it is a plague. I call it a plague because everybody's getting on your cell phones, on your... Even if you have a landline, you get on your landline, and it's almost every day nonstop. It seems like, though they kind of fall into patterns, but it's just a real plague that we need to deal with.
Right. If you have your robocalls nightmare stories for us or any other questions, you can get in contact with us by email inthemoment@sdpb.org. Send us a text, 605-956-7372. Send me a tweet, Jackie Hendry SD, or even Facebook, facebook.com/techradio. Plenty of ways to get in touch with us if you've got questions of your own. Kind of taking a turn to our next news of the week, looking again at the rise of these antitrust investigations, probes in Congress, looking to, in their perspective, improve competition in our growing digital world. Jeff, what's kind of the status right now?
Well, there's just actually a new Time article that came out that's doing a little bit more detail, but and basically antitrust investigations are about to start against Amazon, Apple, Google, I can't remember the other one, Facebook. So yeah, all the big, top name people, all the presidential candidates that are bashing. And it's kind of funny because the FTC is looking to be lead investigation for Facebook and Amazon, while the Department of Justice will be the lead on Apple and Google. And Google just got hit in Europe, antitrust, with a $1.7 billion fine a little earlier this year. So for some of their practices, mainly around the phone business. So it's their browser and stuff. So it's an interesting time. Everyone is kind of getting on the board, the bandwagon to go beat up the tech companies. Some of it's probably warranted, some of it's not. One of the things to remember, DOJ doesn't usually do these very often unless they know they can actually win their cases. It's actually pretty rare to have an antitrust investigation, and especially any kind of court proceedings, unless they have a slam dunk. So, because they're kind of hard to prove many times. But after the European Union did the $1.7 billion fine against Google, it looks like this is ramping up. So the main problems the companies are probably going to have once these investigations start is being able to acquire new companies, being able to expand, right? So because all that stuff will be really put on held and closely watched until the investigations are done. So, but we'll have to wait and see how they all come out. So it seems like both parties, all of Congress, all the candidates are all wanting to bash the tech people for all their problems. So we'll see how it comes out.
Right. And Joel, when we're looking at this, it almost seems like these companies, they've risen to this size because people appreciate the product, right? Or they appreciate the service, and that's why they've become this successful. But because of that success, now they've almost become so big that it makes people nervous.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. They've risen to this level, I think, because people like them. I think there's also, something to be said for the fact that honestly, regulators cannot keep up with technology. I mean, to be fair, most people can't keep up with how technology moves. Mm. And they're very smart about their moves, whether you're talking about Apple or Amazon. I really think some of what we're seeing is not necessarily geared towards the consumer. With the current administration, I really feel like This is maybe their way of putting pressure on some of these kind of left-leaning companies to maybe adopt some of the things or stop adopting some of the things that they've been doing lately, such as YouTube suspending the accounts of right-wing people, and you know, the perceived idea that that there's a left-leaning ban on certain users, whether you're talking about Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. Whether that's true or not, I can't help thinking that some of this news coming all at once and dropping this time, you know, just less than 2 years from an election, maybe is a little suspect. I would rather have seen this maybe up front. I would believe it was more realistic and less strategic if that were the case. And particularly with Ajit Pai, who is almost completely transparently doing the bidding of people above him, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's an interesting perspective, because when it comes to these social media aspects, as you're saying, like when we're looking at banning certain types of accounts, this is almost, at least from my observation, it's largely been kind of this, I don't know if I want to say grassroots sorts of thing, but when we're looking at patently white supremacist speech or things like this, it's not always just kind of your garden variety right-leaning or left-leaning thing. It's something that like people perceive as violent and wondering what the role is of that platform in fighting this. But I agree, from particular sides of different spectrums, you can really color your perspective on those things.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I'll mention is, you know, these, whether it's FCC or the Justice Department, they're always looking at, you know, antitrust possibilities. Not very often do they announce, hey, we're gonna take a look and split these five companies up. They don't do that. Mm-hmm. So unless they are really far along in the process, which they're not right now. Mm-hmm. So it's, again, it seems, you know, why are you dropping this information when you literally have nothing? You haven't started an investigation. It just seems like they've dropped this information so that they can, you know, prove, hey, we're coming after you guys, so start, you know, lining up behind us and doing what we want. It's just the Trump administration loves to use things for leverage, and I just can't help feeling that that's exactly what this is. I mean, there are a lot of issues, and antitrust is only one of them, but that's the only one that they've been talking about with regards to these tech companies. So and I don't know.
Yeah. And intriguing enough, it seems like a lot of Republicans are to a certain extent split on this one. You have some very in favor of going for this one, but then also you have your kind of more traditional conservative or Republican perspective of minimal government regulation.
Absolutely.
And those are the ones kind of hedging on this
one. It's actually funny you mention that, because on the left, they're also very split. You know, you have your maybe people that lead more towards socialism who are also for breaking that up. And, and maybe you have your more moderate Democrats who are not. So, I mean, it's a very strange coalition, and one that kind of breaks more with the ideological leanings of the Trump administration, not so much the Republican Party, which, again, just I think lends itself even more to that. So we'll see how it shakes out. I really don't think it's going to go anywhere. I think the whole big deal was the announcement, so they could use it as leverage, which is the favorite thing that the Trump administration likes to do. So it's too close to an election. Nothing's really going to happen. So, yeah, that's what I think.
Jeff, where are you with this one? Do you think this is just kind of a shock and awe kind of move, or are we actually going to see any results from this?
Somewhat, but it can also be used as benefits, especially on the privacy. Apple, and get to that later, is doing a new privacy kind of push and stuff, because, you know, a large part of the Facebook is privacy. And the concerns around privacy and the information, the data they have of everybody. On Google, a lot of it is how they bundle with the phone and force companies into their ecosystem. So you have to only use their ecosystem. A little bit with that with Apple, a lot with the Apple Store, that you have to, you know, buy your apps through there and all that kind of stuff. which is better security, but is, you know, it's, they're the gatekeepers, right? They get a lot of power and decide what's allowed, what's not. So we'll see kind of how it all plays out. There's a lot of interesting dynamics and stuff. One of the things with the YouTube that I found kind of interesting is and many people have to remember, these companies are there to make money. Mm. YouTube and their new policies have been going back and forth the last couple of days. And in that wash to, you know, ban white supremacists, they demonetized many journalist channels too, because they reported on white supremacy news or did documentaries. And everyone was up in arms about that. But from YouTube's perspective is, well, the advertisers don't really want to advertise on your channels talking about these subjects no matter what. So work more in it for the money, not really the content and stuff. And when they get pushed from the advertisers is when they make their changes. Every time YouTube has ever changed the policies, because their advertisers have spoken up and either pulled ads or said they're going to pull ads. So and many times a lot of this stuff can be influenced by outside just through the money channels too.
Right. My guests are Jeff Litterick with the Bureau of Information and Technology, Mac Guru, Joel Brovelite here in the studio with me. If you have your questions for us, still plenty of time, email us in the moment at sdpb.org. Send us a text, 605-956-7372, or send me a tweet at JackieHendrySD. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we talk Windows patch updates and plenty others, and maybe some of your questions too. You're listening to Tech Radio on SDPB. Welcome back to In the Moment Tech Radio. I'm Jackie Hendry, filling in this week for Kent Osborne. In the studio with me, I have our resident Mac guru, Joel Brovelite, and on the phone from Pierre, Jeff Litterick with the Bureau of Information and Telecommunications for the state of South Dakota. And Jeff, here's where I need you to carry me, because I don't know a lot about this Windows patch update that was pushed through recently, but it sounds like it's been a pretty big deal.
Yeah, it's one of those types of exploits that's easy to pull off and internet-wide ranging. And a lot of people, even at home, sometimes open up stuff so they can get back to their home machines, and this vulnerability allows them to be easily taken over. It's one of those ones, if you go back in history, like SQL Slammer and stuff, that's can basically, you know, tear down large parts of the internet if activated and they use it. So what happened was in remote desktop, and basically this is a functionality built into every Windows box all the way back through NT and XP to allow people to remotely log into their or another Windows machine. Many people use it to log in at work for like help desk to log in and help people, or even people logging into their home machines at home to, you know, do stuff on their home machines. It's in every single Windows box. It's on by default. It's turned on. And there's now that just came out, a very simple exploit that allows an attacker, all they have to do is be able to contact your machine on a wireless network, on anything, on this port, and take over your machine immediately and make it part of a botnet. This was so critical that Microsoft backported the patch to Windows XP and Windows Vista, both OSs they no longer do security patches for normally. But this was so critical, they backported it to every single version of Windows. The NSA has come out and urging people to patch. Microsoft is almost begging their customers to get this patch out and rolled out. And this week, the exploits started rolling out, so they're out there and easy to take over. And since it affects every single Windows machine, unless you have patched this month, since the last Tuesday, it came out in May, so it's been 3 Tuesdays now. You are vulnerable. It's one of those things that if you take, like, especially laptop stuff or a Surface tablet, you take it around, you will be compromised unless you patch. There's really no two ways about it. You need to patch. And this is really frightening for businesses and ransomware. Like Baltimore City is still down after how many weeks? This is one of those things that once an attacker gets a foothold inside your firewall, they could use this to infect every single Windows machine in your network in seconds. This is a really bad one. You need to patch. And yes, if you're still running XP and there's still some out there or Vista, go ahead and get the patch because, yes, I know you're not used to patching, but there is a patch for this one out because it is so critical.
Wow, that's wild. How often do we see something kind of catastrophic is alarmist, but it seems like a big enough deal if they're begging all their users to patch.
Yeah, there's kind of another one for Linux email servers right now with a particular email program that has kind of the same thing, but it's a little bit more limited. We tend to see these about once every 3-4 years. This is not the first one. It won't be the last one, but it's usually not, you know, there's always ways to mitigate stuff like, well, oh, they need to have local access to your machine, or they need firewall holes open, or other stuff. In this case, people use this protocol so often they punch holes through firewalls. They allow this stuff from the internet because it is secure. And one of the dangers with this thing is it's because it is secure communication, most of the normal security tools cannot tell if you're being attacked and being compromised because everything is encrypted. Even the attack itself is encrypted and exploit. So it's, you know, it's that everyone uses it. The hole is on every single Windows machine ever made . It's those two that come together that make it just so dangerous. And like I said, about every 3, maybe every 5 years, we run into one of these.
Wow. Just kind of the nature of the game in tech, trying to keep up with everything, and sometimes things just don't really go as planned, and you need to make up for them.
This protocol is used by a lot of vendors, like ATM machines and stuff, for remote access and remote diagnostics and remote fixing of problems. So it's one of those things that everyone uses. It's open every place, and I don't need any usernames or passwords. I just need to be able to reach out with an IP packet and touch your machine, and I have compromised your entire machine and have taken it over. So it's a bad one. It needs to be patched. Microsoft almost never backports patches like this. If they did it, they know it's super important that everybody patch.
In other news, we're seeing a lot of other kind of hardware updates, all sorts of different things. Memory prices are falling. What can you tell us about that one, Jeff? I know that's also kind of in your specialty.
Outside the big Apple development conference this week, there's also been the last 2 weeks some big trade show hardware stuff. Intel's releasing their new CPUs. There's a lot of new PCI specs coming out for a new PCI set. And while we can get technical, we don't really need to. What it really means is there's going to be even faster SSDs out, faster storage, faster RAM at cheaper pricing, CPUs with much more core. Intel is actually selling a CPU now that can run at 5 gigahertz every single core at full speed with air cooling, and it can run at 24/7 forever. So lots of unique little advances. Brand new motherboards are coming out. Just on the upper ends to support the new SSD specs and new channel bus specs. It's kind of outside video cards. Just about everything is getting a massive upgrade here in the next few months, and everything's really being announced today. So there's new actual multiple terabyte SSDs that are about twice as fast as the ones that are out today coming out here soon. It's going to be an exciting time, and memory pricing is going way down. Intel has their new memory architecture coming out that's also flash. So the way this works, it's kind of a neat new concept, is your storage is your RAM. You put this in, and it acts like an SSD, except it's also all your RAM. So when you are running your computer, if you shut it off, when you turn it back on, it doesn't need to boot or anything. It actually has all the memory stored permanently for every program, and they just all start running again.
Wow.
Kind of like how tablets and stuff work.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, except even tablets, reboot and have to refresh the OS. This does it. There's some really exciting times. It's been kind of a couple of dry years, especially with the Meltdown and Spectre patch stuff that came out for hardware-wise announcements and excitement. But it's really ramping up this year. There's going to be a lot of new stuff, especially late summer, this fall coming out, in terms of just raw performance at really affordable pricing and a humongous increase in speed on storage.
So for the average consumer who maybe they don't even have like a good gaming computer that, and they're just kind of going through their day-to-day stuff, is that the main impact that we're going to see with these developments is lower prices for better speed?
Somewhat. The very low end is probably going to remain about the same. But in terms of server and the higher end pro workstations, Apple, as we'll get to, has announced kind of off this new hardware announcement, their own version of their MacBook, their Mac Pros and stuff. The professional stuff is going to get a big increase and boost. Gaming will be a kind of a big increase and boost. At the low end, you're going to see better speeds. You're going to see better, faster access. Your programs are going to speed up, but the pricing is going to remain about the same. But when you really look at the high-end stuff, you're going to get a lot more bang for your buck.
Great. In other news this week, as we've mentioned a couple times now, Apple had their WWDC conference. Joel, probably the thing that I've heard the most people talking about from that is the reported demise of iTunes. How is that actually going to factor into functionality of things?
Well, first off, I want to say, yes, Apple's going to phase out iTunes, but I don't think it's as big a deal as a lot of people think. First off, if you don't use a Mac, like a desktop or a laptop, it's not going to affect you at all. So if you're using your iPhone or your iPad or using a Windows machine, nothing's going to change. As far as Windows goes, they're still going to use iTunes. They haven't said that they're going to switch to separate applications for all of the functions that iTunes does. So if you're using Windows, nothing changes for you. If you're using an iPhone or an iPad, nothing changes because you've already been using Apple Music and podcasts and books. Nothing changes there. The desktop version and laptop version, their full OS, is just going to switch to basically mirror that of the mobile operating system. So there's going to be a separate app for music, and there's going to be a separate app for books. And what I should say is audiobooks will just roll over into the books app that's already existing there, and podcasts will be its own app. So if you've got an iTunes gift card or something that you're worried about using, don't worry about it. You'll be able to use that forever. Nothing changes there. The iTunes store will still be available. It's actually still going to be called the iTunes Store, from what I understand. One thing I'd like to highlight, and I haven't seen this written anywhere, is Apple's music player would have been called Apple Music or iMusic. It's not called iMusic, and by the way, they don't put an I in front of anything anymore. So you can, iTunes is the very last vestige of anything with an I in front of it, except for maybe the iMac. Anyway, I digress. Apple couldn't use music. They couldn't use Music Store or Apple Music because of this long-running lawsuit that they used to have with Apple Music, which is the original label for the Beatles.
Oh, of course.
And there was still litigation around that, which I think was about 12 years ago, 15 years ago, when they first started doing this. So they couldn't say iMusic or Apple Music. They couldn't do that. So their best option was iTunes. Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons they're doing that is now they've settled that lawsuit quite a while ago. So they're kind of bringing things in line so that the whole platform is kind of consistent. And so they're kind of losing that designation, which they haven't really wanted to use for new products for quite some time. So, not a really big deal for anybody. The functionality will be exactly the same, maybe a little easier for you.
Right. We'll get more from the Apple conference this week coming up, but before we take a quick break, a listener question. This listener says, I need to set up a new personal and business or new personal and business emails. I'm considering paying for a secure email service like StartMail. What are your thoughts? Maybe Jeff, we'll start with you. Is it worth paying extra for a secure service?
Yes, especially on the business side. Especially if you're going to be dealing with anything over email like payroll records or anything what we call PII data, personal data for data of your customers. Mm-hmm. having that option for encryption is very, very important for security to protect that kind of data. Personally, I probably wouldn't. On the business side, yes, the state has secure email and stuff in place for a lot of that kind of stuff for those reasons, to protect privacy and the data. So it really depends on what you're doing personally. If you really need to protect that and secure that, and you don't want, you know, that kind of level of security and data protection or not. So business, yes, it makes sense anymore to have that as part of your role in. And plus with business, your business is relying a large part on your email. You do want to pay. You do get what you pay for. You're going to get better service, better data protection, better backup of your emails in case something gets lost or corrupted. Your personal one is more of a judgment call on what you do use your personal email for.
Mm-hmm. And are there any, I'm not familiar with some of these paid secure email services. StartMail is the one mentioned in this comment. Are there any others that are kind of standouts, or is it just kind of on a research basis you find what works best for you?
Well, there's two categories. If you like using Office 365, there's lots of different options there, or what we call on-prem. If you have your own email server, that you're managing, either hosted for you or someplace else, but you're managing, there's a whole bunch of different options. If you just want to be web-based, a service-type thing, there's less options. You need to review the pricing and stuff. I've always kind of focused on the bigger solutions, the on-prem and dedicated stuff versus just the like the StartMail too much. So can't really recommend anything too much on that side of the house.
Great. It's about time we take another short break. When we come back, we'll have more news from the Apple conference earlier this week, what you can expect developments from there. You're listening to In the Moment Tech Radio on SDPB. Welcome back to In the Moment Tech Radio. I'm Jackie Hendry, and in for Kent Osborne this week. And now we are all about Apple Worldwide Developers Conference and news from that this week. Joel, you are very excited about sign-in with Apple.
Right. This, because there were so many announcements, didn't really get a lot of play. If you heard anything about it, it probably wasn't about this. But if you're familiar with signing in anywhere at all, you've seen options where you can sign in with Google, you can sign in with Facebook, you can sign in with Amazon. And Apple, of course, is rolling out their own sign in with Apple. That sounds like not a big deal, an obvious choice. But the big difference is Apple is not going to share. This is what they say they're going to do, and you know, they say it, they're going to do it. I mean, that's just how that works. They're not sharing your information with that developer. And so much so that when you sign in using your Apple account, you'll be able to use it using your fingerprint or your Face ID on your mobile device, on your iPhone or iPad or on the laptop, whatever you've got. So you won't have to type anything in. And if it if you want it to, and it will do this by default, it'll generate a email address specific for that sign in that you can then ditch later on or keep going and find out, you know, if that developer is using that email, not taking your information, but using that email and sending that to other people. You can just shut that off and it'll generate as many email addresses as you want. Wow. For as many sign-ins as you want. And it will keep track of all of that for you.
Wow.
So that's going to be a pretty powerful tool and I think very useful for a lot of people.
Right, kind of tracking that who's using your information in ways that you don't want them to, so
yeah,
you can avoid it.
Exactly.
Great. And kind of along that vein, this is kind of on a bit of a tangent, but not really, as we're seeing more developments with the Apple Watch and some of this wearable technology. I was reading something this morning, kind of looking to the Apple Watch as the gold standard in wearable tech, health-related tech, and all these things that we're able to track with that technology. And announced this week, a couple updates to the Apple Watch. We're looking at it alerts you if you are in an environment that is so loud that it has the potential for hearing damage, which I think is really interesting for us concert goers and things
Absolutely.
Like that. Yeah. And then another addition, I'm not aware if this was in any way a capability before or not, but menstrual cycle
tracking. Yeah, absolutely.
Which, of course, I mean, I I can speak for most women of a certain age using smart technology. I've been using that through third-party apps since I had a smartphone.
Right, sure. And, you know, it allows you, and this is built into watchOS 6, which will come out in fall, and it'll be free for anybody that uses an Apple Watch, whether you get a new one or whether you've got one that's a year or two old.
Mm-hmm.
You're referring to cycle tracking, and it will help you track your menstrual cycle, receive fertility updates, and even predict when your period is about to start. So you've got all that data. And when you walk into your doctor's office, you can say, okay, well, it looks like maybe it's 31 days this time, it's 34. So you can discuss that with them. Plus, you know, again, if you're trying to get pregnant, this is stuff you need to do. And you don't have to necessarily, you know, use this app here and subscribe to this and buy this. And is this one work? No, it didn't work. So I have to download another one.
Right.
It's just kind of built in and integrated with your other health information. So you can input like, you know, I felt, you know, I had a temperature that day or other information, like I exercised this much amount. It's all gathered together. And I should mention that not only for the Apple Watch, if you want to use this cycle tracking, it will actually, you'll be able to do all the same stuff, but it obviously won't be able to keep track of your pulse with your iPhone. So if you don't have a watch, you'll still be able to use cycle tracking in the new version of iOS 13. So yeah, that's a very big deal. And you had mentioned the hearing health. That's a pretty fantastic feature that's, you know, I don't think anybody asked for, but will be super useful. You'll be able to basically, you'll be able to look at your watch and it will warn you if the decibels are above whatever amount that is healthy or whatever you set it to, which could be useful for, you know, people, concert goers, but it could also be useful for parents who maybe might go into a situation where they think, oh, this is too loud for my kid. I need to put the ear muffs on or we need to get out of here. So yeah, very, very cool stuff.
Yeah, kind of exciting and something as someone who has never gotten into the wearable technology, at least not yet, but on my smartphones, and I'm a recent convert to the iPhone, I will tell you this. I've been very happy so far, about 6-month anniversary with my new iPhone, and we're very happy together. But before that, with kind of our Android, all the variety of third-party apps that you're just kind of trying to piece together for these different looks at, like, oh, I had a headache this day, or here's what I'm looking at for this, wellness and in all aspects of that phrase, it's kind of exciting to see these developments and having kind of everything, regardless of who you are, on one piece of wearable technology. But then a critique I have seen is, where is this stored and who can access it?
Well, and they covered that, actually. They said with all of your health data, it's actually stored on your device, on your phone. If you use it on the watch, it's stored on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
It's not sent anywhere. You have total control over it. It is never sent anywhere. If you want to give data to your doctor or whatever, you have to actively do that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no way to track that. And of course, if you have two-factor authentication set up on your iPhone, which you do if you use either Face ID or Touch ID, it is as safe as it possibly could be. It's safer than if it was in a filing cabinet in your house.
Wow.
And it's always been that way since they came up with the health app. They know it's really important to people. Apple has the luxury of not making their money off of advertisement like the other companies that you might refer to, whether it's Google or certainly Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have to worry about that. And you mentioned it's nice to have everything all in one place. Well, that's how they get you.
Right.
That's how they get you.
That's how they're winning me over to thinking about maybe I need to be saving up for an Apple Watch now. Let's see. Plenty of other stuff from Apple. Another thing I saw, I'm not sure how useful. Again, I have an iPad, haven't used it in a long time because I don't love the functionality. It's one of the older ones, too. But developing a specific iOS for the iPad, how much of a functionality are we seeing? Is this a huge game changer or not so much?
It's not a game changer. It's really probably more for them than it is for anybody else.
Mm.
You know, originally when iOS had come up, the iPhone was first, and then they came up with the tablet version, and the operating systems were virtually the same. The iPad was just bigger. But as the iPad gained more functionality through multitasking and being able to open second windows and using a pencil, it just became way too much information to stick on your iPhone to then not use, and vice versa, using some things on your phone might use that the iPad just doesn't. So it allows them to really trim down, I think, some of that operating system, baggage. So it's probably more for them than anybody else. There is an update to the iPads. We're not going to get to that now. So it's probably just so that they can differentiate the two. It won't affect anybody out there. And you don't have to adopt it if you don't want. And that's true of all of these updates. If you don't want the update to this, that, or the other thing, you don't have to update to that. If you want to keep iTunes, just don't update your operating system. You're going to be able to do that. However, since they have over a 90% adoption rate to new operating systems, you're probably going to switch.
Right. And speaking of updates, Jeff, I promise we'll loop you into the conversation soon, but I'm kind of nerding out here with Joel about Apple.
That never happens.
I've been using my iPod Classic for, I don't know, over a decade now.
Since you've had it.
Yeah, pretty much. And just been perfectly happy with it. Someone else also asked me, and I realized I didn't have an answer to this question, if iTunes is going away, can I keep using that?
Absolutely, yeah. And that will just work with the new music app if you're syncing it with your desktop computer. If you're syncing with a Windows computer, that certainly won't change. You won't even have to change the app that you open because it still will be iTunes. I think if everything goes well, they probably will switch the Windows platform over to three separate applications as well. They just haven't done that yet. Obviously, they're going to take care of their own installed user base first and see how that goes. And then, because anytime they update anything for Windows, it's a bit trickier because they've got lots more hardware to take into account.
Right. About a minute and a half left. Any other like exciting takeaways from WWDC this year?
Well, and these people probably already know, but what I'll say is if you're a professional that does either video or audio editing or photo editing, and you need a lot of horsepower and need a fast computer, they just announced some pretty fantastic computers that are going to come out in the fall, the Mac Pro. You should just go check it out on the website. We can probably talk it on a subsequent show, but yeah, probably the best update they've ever done for the Pro models of computer.
Some very nice monitors to go with them.
Yes, mm-hmm. and some very steep pricing to go with it. but so not for mere mortals, but for those that need it, it's really going to be pretty amazing.
Not for mere mortals. I would wear that t-shirt. That sounds like a good marketing ploy. My guests have been resident Mac guru Joel Brovelite in our Kirby family studio. Joel, thanks for joining us on the program this week.
Thank you.
And Jeff Litterick with the Bureau of Information and Telecommunications on the phone from Pierre. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us this week as well. Really appreciate it.
Have a good day, everyone.